Hello there, and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. We are in part 38 of our 66-part series in all of the books of the Bible, and today we are looking at Ruth chapter 1 with his teaching entitled The Tears of Naomi. The book of Ruth is set in the 13th century BCE, and it takes place in a town called Bethlehem. In this town, a young woman is born. Her name is Naomi, and she grows up in this land of Israel. Naomi grows up hearing about the one God who is God of all. This God created all and crafted all and loves all, but God has a special place within God's heart for this nation of Israel. Naomi grows up in Bethlehem, and she begins to trust this faith for herself. Now imagine for a second if we could have Naomi on this podcast with us when she is 11 years old. What do you think she would tell us about God? Now, as an 11-year-old, she doesn't have a whole lot of life experience to draw from, but we can imagine that she would tell us what her parents have told her to be true, because she has no reason at 11 years old to distrust this. So I think that she would tell us on this podcast something like this: if I am faithful to God, then God will take care of me. That would be Naomi's testimony. A few years later, she meets a man named Elimelech, and then shortly after that, they are married. Shortly after the marriage, then, she conceives and then gives birth to a son named Mahlon. A few years later, she conceives once again, and once again, it's a son, and she gives birth to her second son, a boy named Chilion. This was very good news 3,200 years ago because boys meant something different than girls when they were born into a family. You see, as boys grow up and they marry, they stay within the family of their parents. But when girls grow up within ancient Jewish society, when they marry into someone else's family. And so women and girls and daughters leave their parents, whereas sons stay with their parents in this tradition. Now, this may seem insignificant to you, but what this means is that Naomi is in a very secure position. She has her husband to take care of her, and if something, God forbid, happened to her husband, then she would have her oldest son, Mahlon, and then her second son, Chilion, to take care of her for the rest of her life. So now Naomi has some life experience to draw on. Imagine how her testimony might change if she were to come on this podcast at this point in her life. Rather than just saying what her parents told her, she can now draw from her personal experience and share her testimony from what she has lived through. I picture Naomi at this point in her life saying to us, "Look, I was faithful to God, and God has taken care of me. I have a husband. I have two healthy baby boys. We live in a land that we love. Things are good. We love and worship this good God, Yahweh." So everything in Naomi's life is going according to plan. And then something changes. A famine devastates the land. Now, theology has changed a lot in the last 3,200 years. And to give you some perspective on how much this has changed, when a famine strikes the land today, we often point to things like global warming or weather patterns or explanations that help us understand why this suffering is occurring and what can we do to prevent it in the future. But 3,200 years ago, science wasn't quite what it is today. And so what happened was theology would step in and they would interpret natural disasters all through the lens of their own faith. And because of this, everything that happened was the will of God. And so when there was an abundance of rains, which translated into an abundance of crops, it was viewed as God's divine favor or blessing on the people who were living there. So clearly, in their minds, they must have done something right to earn such abundance and favor from God. Conversely, though, when a famine struck the land, this was interpreted as God is angry with us. And there would be all kinds of calls for repentance, to return and go back to a revival of what religion once was before. So here is Naomi with her family. Everything is set and secured, and then a famine shows up and it devastates the land. It devastates the land so much that Naomi and Elimelech are forced to take their two young baby boys across the hot desert and seek refuge in another country that has an adequate food supply. Eventually, Naomi and her family of refugees take shelter in the nation of Moab. And you can imagine this family, where everything was once set and perfect and in place, is now living in a foreign land they did not want to live in. And they were watching sunsets over mountains that are unfamiliar and eating food that doesn't taste quite the same as the food from home. And if we could have Naomi at this point on our podcast and ask her to tell us about God, I think that she would respond by saying to us, "I do not understand why God is so angry with me, with my family, and with my country." This is a difficult situation for Naomi and her family to process. And the tragedy is, it gets much more difficult. Shortly after arriving in Moab as refugees, the unthinkable happens. Naomi's husband, Elimelech, suddenly and inexplicably dies. And Naomi is left to raise these two young boys in Moab by herself. I cannot imagine the pain and the suffering and the absence one has to deal with when it comes to burying your spouse. And Naomi now is living through this pain. I can't imagine. And if we could talk to Naomi and ask her about God during this point in her life, I don't think that she'd have a lot of answers. I think the truth that would come out from that conversation is that she would say something along these lines. She would say to us, "I don't deserve this. There's nothing I did that could possibly justify the pain of having to deal with my husband's death." And you can imagine that Naomi doesn't really know which way is up and which way is down anymore, and she's just struggling to make it through each day. And the thing that is keeping her going is she has to be there for her two sons. And so she continues to take one day at a time. She continues to put one foot in front of the other, even in the face of overwhelming despair. And after a few years, Mahlon is old enough to marry, and he marries a Moabite woman named Orpah. Shortly after that, her younger son, Chilion, marries a Moabite woman named Ruth. And so while there is overwhelming pain, we can imagine that Naomi starts to feel a little bit of hope again. Her sons have both married, and it should not be too much longer before she is holding a grandson or a granddaughter. Because marriage 3,200 years ago was primarily for procreation. And so Naomi watches both of her sons get married, and she knows it's only a matter of time, and so she waits for a grandchild. And she waits. And she waits. She waits. She waits for 10 years, and neither of her daughters-in-law are pregnant. Now, I don't know if you have personally struggled with infertility or if you have watched a loved one struggle with infertility. But I will tell you, when I have watched my friends and my family go through infertility, this is one of those lonely journeys that is taboo to speak about in our society today. The journey of infertility is a lonely and devastating one. The journey of infertility requires this ever-present hope to keep trying. And that hope is often met with a devastating or terrible answer in response. And so we often read this story, and we read about how 10 years after they get married, they are still without children. And it seems to go by in just an instant for us, but anyone who has struggled with infertility knows that that is not an instant. It is drawn out and is a battle, and it is frustrating and it's heartaching. And so Naomi watches her two sons go through these infertility struggles, and her heart breaks over and over and over again with each passing month. And as Naomi is trying to wrestle with the infertility that is happening within her family, things get even worse because Mahlon, her son, unexpectedly and suddenly dies without much warning. And now Naomi is forced to go through what is probably the most painful journey on this planet, which is to bury one's own child. To make matters even worse, within that year of Mahlon's death, her second son, her youngest son, Chilion, also dies. And so Naomi is forced to bury two sons within a year. This is a woman who has known more grief than most human beings ever face in a lifetime. And I can't imagine, it's hard for me to even talk about imagining this pain, let alone her living through it. And after she buries both sons, we see how this has devastated her. And she talks about her testimony in verse 20 of chapter 1 in Ruth. She says these words, "I am bitter because God has treated me bitterly." And you can imagine that if Naomi was sitting in front of you or me and she said these words, I would try to calm her down. I would try to say something like, I know times are tough, but remember there are some good things in life. And I imagine Naomi saying back to me, like what? I wouldn't have a response. Because Naomi is living in a painful and tragic life. So Naomi has her two daughter-in-laws who are also widows with her. They don't have much value within a patriarchal society, do they? And it's here that Naomi hears that the famine is finally done in Bethlehem. And she doesn't have much choice left, so she decides that she's going to return back to Israel, back to Bethlehem, and try and find some way of living there. Her best option is most likely that she is a beggar, or if she gets really lucky, then one of her widowed daughter-in-laws marries into a family with some money, and they take on Naomi as a charity project. And so Naomi and Orpah and Ruth, all of them grieving the loss of their husbands, of their brothers-in-laws, of their sons, of just their lives and their security, are walking back to Bethlehem. And on the way back, Naomi stops on the road and she turns to Orpah and to Ruth. And she looks at these two young women following her across the desert, and she must be overwhelmed by their plight. She says to them these words, which appear in Ruth 1, 8, and 9. She says, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find security, each of you, in the house of your husband." Naomi sets them free. She lets them go. She says, don't follow me. This is not a road with any kind of hope. Go back to your house. Go back to your family and try to find a new life. Because the life with me is a dead end. Naomi sets them free and asks them to leave her alone to die in her bitterness. And then we read that Ruth and Orpah and Naomi all begin to weep on a dusty road between Moab and Bethlehem. Now, I don't picture this as a weepy, like, oh, I'm going to miss you. It'll be nice to see you again one day, maybe. I picture this as a wailing lament, as a scream, as a cry out of the pain that each of these women are bearing. The life has just been too much for all of them. And here is Naomi down to her last hope, and she turns these two women and says, please don't follow me. And this weeping and wailing for how unfair and unjust life has been to Naomi. And so through their tears and through their agony, both Ruth and Orpah say to Naomi, no, we will return with you to your people. And Naomi hears this and says to them these words, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Do I still have sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. Even if I thought there was hope for me, even if I should have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you then wait until they were grown? Would you then refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, it has been far more bitter for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me. And when you think about those words that Naomi is saying, that God has looked at Naomi and has decided to be against Naomi, these are very different words from the testimony that we started out with. Young Naomi operated under this idea that if I am faithful to God, then God will take care of me. But then we look at Naomi decades later, living through life and actually having those life experiences and telling us what she has found to be true. God has not taken care of me. God is against me. I am filled with bitterness. And in Ruth 1:13, she says, no, my daughters, it has been far more bitter for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me. My brothers and sisters, it's important for us to understand the kind of life and viewpoint and understanding of the world that Naomi has right now, because Naomi is living in darkness, isn't she? Just utter, complete darkness with blinding uncertainty, more pain than she can bear, and this hopeless sense that the God of the universe is against her. Naomi is living in darkness. Now, we're talking about a story in the Bible. And in the Bible, there are all kinds of miracles that happen from the very beginning until the very end of this book. So let's assume for a moment that you don't know the rest of this story. Let's pause right here on this road where Naomi says that God is against me and I am filled with bitterness. In this moment, if God wanted this to be a miracle story, and God could create a miracle in the midst of Naomi's darkness, what would that miracle look like? What would be the thing that the all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing God could do to make this darkness go away? Well, it's here that most Christians would respond to this question by saying, that's easy. God could resurrect her dead husband, Elimelech, her dead son, Mahlon, and her dead son, Chilion. God could just give their lives back, bring them up out of their graves in Moab, and guide them, walk them straight to Naomi in the midst of all of this wailing and depression and darkness, and say, here you go, Naomi. I am a loving God. I'm an all-powerful God. Look at what I did for you. I gave you your loved ones back. Then Ruth, Naomi, Orpah would go and hug their husbands, hug their family, and they would weep with happiness, and they would start singing, "Our God is an awesome God." God would fly back up to heaven, and God would sing, "I am an awesome God." And everybody would be happy. We could preach that story in churches today. Everyone would say amen. They would think of the resurrection that happens at the end of the time, and they would say to themselves, "Thank goodness we have that God with us." So why doesn't God do that in this story? It's a fair question. Naomi is overwhelmed with suffering. And if you believe that God can resurrect people from the dead, then why doesn't God do this here? Is Naomi's suffering not great enough? But instead, Christians who believe that God is all-loving, God is all-powerful, God is all-knowing, sees these three women suffering on the side of the road and decides to do nothing about it according to this story. And that's painful to think about, to hear, and even to believe. Because Naomi is hurting. And when Naomi is hurting this much, we want God to do something about her pain. And God seemingly doesn't do anything about her pain. There is no miracle, most would say. Now, here's where you might think I'm a bit crazy. Because I think it's the fact that God doesn't resurrect Naomi's loved ones that we read the story. Because we all, at some point, have lived in darkness, haven't we? Now, the darkness you have faced or are currently facing is probably not as great as Naomi's. But we have all experienced that sense of darkness that Naomi feels throughout her life. And maybe you have had to say goodbye to a spouse who has died. Maybe you have had to bury a child. And if you have, then you know how much pain is in that process. And I can imagine that if you have lived through that horrible evil, that if you were to hear a story about God intervening and resurrecting loved ones from the grave in this life, you would ask yourself this question: why does Naomi get the miracle of resurrection and I do not? Why does she get that? Because it's almost like God says, here's a get out of jail free card from the darkness. Why don't I get one? The Greeks had a term for this, and the term was deus ex machina. And it was a term that originated from their theater. And the idea behind deus ex machina is that you would write stories about the human experience. And these stories would often raise tensions or questions or darknesses for the characters in a play. And one of the most difficult things that humans have to do in this life is live in the midst of darkness, live with questions, live with tension all around them. And so what playwrights would do is sometimes to get their human characters out of that tension or darkness, what they would do is they would sometimes write about a God who would intervene, drop down from the top of the stage, give the main character some weapon or some device or some miracle to help them get out of the tension, out of the darkness. While this is convenient and it's easy to help move a story along, the Greek playwrights often thought of this as lazy. For the Greeks, to have a god drop down out of the sky and change things didn't really mirror the human experience, and so they viewed that literary device as unimaginative. And if God were to resurrect Elimelech and Mahlon and Chilion and bring them back and call Naomi out of this darkness, then I think that we'd stop reading it. Because all of a sudden, the story of Naomi is not a human story. But because Naomi is living in this darkness for so long and it's overwhelming, we read it and we say, how does she get through this? because trying to get through darkness is a very difficult task. It's so difficult that on the side of the road, she at one point turns to her two daughter-in-laws who are suffering just as much as she is. And she says to them, "No, my daughters, it has been far more bitter for me than for you because the hand of the Lord has turned against me." And Naomi is saying, "I have to journey through this darkness. Leave me because everything I touch falls apart." And Naomi does not see a way through the darkness. Now it's here that I think we should talk about miracles again. What kind of miracle would God do in the middle of Naomi's darkness? Because if God can somehow help Naomi through the darkness, if Naomi can find God in the midst of this darkness, well, then that would be a miracle, wouldn't it? I mean, if Naomi somehow, after this time on the road, finds love and purpose and value within this life, which Christians have referred to as finding God, then that would be a miracle, because this poor woman has been through everything this life can throw at her. Just to recap, Naomi is dealing with the death of her husband, the death of her oldest son, the death of her youngest son, famine, starvation, overwhelming sexist oppression due to the patriarchy, being a refugee in a foreign land, returning home without her family, poverty, bankruptcy, infertility in both of her sons' families, blinding uncertainty, the weight of Orpah and Ruth's futures, and the soul-crushing feeling of abandonment by God. If Naomi can somehow, someway, find God, find purpose, find beauty, find hope in the midst of all of this darkness, that would be a miracle. You know what we call that? We call that redemption. If God can somehow redeem Naomi's suffering and take all of Naomi's bitterness and soften her heart once again so that she feels open to what life can offer and can be, well, that would be a miracle. And that is the miracle of redemption. Here we have a story of a woman who is hurting, who is broken. And it's here that we ask the question, what does God's redemption look like for Naomi? Because Naomi's story in the book of Ruth is a story of God's redemption. And if you have eyes to see what God's redemption looks like in this story, then you can see how God can work redemption with the darkness that you are suffering through. So I believe there are three ways that God's redemption works in Naomi's life. And so we'll spend the rest of this podcast talking about the three tangible ways that God redeems Naomi's suffering. First, I want to tell you about a book that I recently read. The book's title is Turtles All the Way Down by the author John Green. In the book, there are two main characters. The first is a woman named Asa Holmes. The second is a man named Davis Pickett. Asa's father died when she was 8 years old, and Davis's mother died when he was 7. A few years later, Asa meets Davis at a camp that is set up for counseling and care for these young children when they've lost their parents at this tender age. So Asa meets Davis, and they begin to bond as friends, and they begin to bond even further by the fact that they have both lost a parent that they loved. And they bond so much that they start to have jokes and inside terminology, and they begin to describe this counseling camp as sad camp. Once the camp draws to a close, Asa and Davis go their separate ways, and they don't speak to each other for 5 years. A chance encounter then brings them back into each other's lives, and it is here where the majority of the story of Turtles All the Way Down occurs. Now, one thing that Asa and Davis love to do as 16-year-olds is to look up at the stars. Davis has studied quite a bit of astrophysics, and so he shares with Asa some of what he's learned. He talks about how the sun is so far away that it takes the light traveling at the speed of light 8 minutes to arrive on the surface of the planet. So when Asa and Davis look up at the sun, they are not seeing the sun as it is. They are instead seeing the sun as it was 8 minutes ago. And so if the sun were to, God forbid, all of a sudden go out, we are here on earth wouldn't know about it for 8 whole minutes. Davis then goes on to another star and he says that star is 4 light years away, which means that we are seeing it as it was 4 years ago. And so after gazing at the stars for some time, Davis invites Asa up to the top of his house. And it's here that he has a telescope and he punches in some coordinates and then gazes through the telescope, and then he invites Asa to look through the telescope as well. As she looks through the telescope, she sees a bright dot, and he says to her, "This is Tau Ceti, and it is my favorite star." Tau Ceti, he tells her, is 12 light years away, and there are 2 planets that we believe are habitable orbiting around it. Asa then asks him, "Why is this your favorite star?" And he says, "I like to imagine myself standing on one of those planets around Tau Ceti, looking through a telescope back here, and I can see life on this Earth as it was 12 years ago. You see, Asa, on that planet, my mother is still alive. She still has 3 years left to live, and the best and the worst of life are still in front of me." Asa then realizes that Davis's greatest fear is that he may one day forget the memory of his mother. This reminds me of a Bible study I was in the 5th grade. It was a Bible study in the book of Revelation, which is a bit heavy for a 5th grader. And I remember sitting in this Bible study, and there's a Bible study leader. And the leader one day was talking about how great heaven will be. And as the Bible study leader was telling us about how great heaven will be, in 5th grade, this was when I started to realize that the people who weren't making it into heaven were actually fun people to be around. They're people that I liked. And I knew friends and family members who probably weren't going to make it into heaven based on this Bible study leader's definition of what gets people into heaven. And so I remember as a 5th grader asking this Bible study leader, "What about the people that don't make it? Because I can imagine I'd be incredibly sad living in heaven without my friends, without the people that I really like." And it was here that the Bible study leader told me not to worry. And then he paraphrased scripture by saying, "God will wipe away your tears." And the Bible study leader meant for this to sound like I won't grieve while I'm in heaven, but what I heard as a 5th grader is that God will wipe away all of my memories of the loved ones who don't make it into heaven. And at that moment, this description of heaven did not sound like heaven at all. It sounded like hell, because I never wanted to forget the people that I loved. And when you speak to people who have lost loved ones, their greatest fear, understandably, as a human being, is that their loved ones will be forgotten. And so when we ask the question, what does God's redemption look like for Naomi? No matter what we answer, it's not that all of a sudden God wipes away her tears and she forgets about Elimelech and Mahlon and Chilion. But instead, it's the opposite. God's redemption remembers what was lost. Mahlon and Chilion and Elimelech will stay in the memory of Naomi, and Naomi will be given space to remember, to feel their absence, to hold closely the warm and thoughtful memories of what it was that she loved about them. And if you've ever heard people speak of God's redemption and it feels hollow or superficial, it's because we're talking about redemption that does not remember what was lost. Now, we're talking about something positive, like a loved family member, right? Let's assume that we're talking about something negative, like slavery in the history of America. Well, God's redemption of slavery does not involve us forgetting about slavery, pretending like it never happened. Rather, God's redemption is through the remembrance of slavery, to remind ourselves of the evils that were caused to build this nation, to recognize how this set up racial inequality within America, and then asks us to do things or make reparations to fix this racial inequality. America's redemption for slavery is not in the ignorance of slavery, but in the acceptance and the condemnation of what slavery was before and the repairs going forward to fix the wrong and the evil in our history. God's redemption remembers what was lost. That is the first thing we can learn about God's redemption of Naomi. Which brings us to the second. Naomi, in chapter 1, verse 13, says to Orpah and Ruth, "No, my daughters, it has been far more bitter for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me." Orpah hears this proclamation of bitterness, hears this proclamation of God being angry with Naomi, and kisses her mother-in-law, and then obeys her mother-in-law and returns to the land of Moab. But Ruth clings to Naomi and makes a life-binding promise to Naomi. She says these words to her, "Do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, Naomi, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There will I be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me and more as well, if even death parts me from you." You see, Ruth hears Naomi say, "God is against me. I am filled with bitterness." And Ruth does not respond to her mother-in-law by saying, "Come on. Come on, Naomi. We're going to get through this. Everything's going to be fine. And remember, God is a good God." She doesn't try to correct her theology. She doesn't make her feel bad for what she's feeling. Instead, she binds herself to Naomi's suffering and essentially says, "God may be your enemy, but I will walk through the darkness with you." And when I consider the words of Ruth to Naomi, I am reminded of one of my favorite songs of all time by the great band Death Cab for Cutie. In their song, "I Will Follow You Into the Dark," the chorus goes like this: "If heaven and hell decide that they both are satisfied, if they illuminate the nose on their vacancy signs, if there's no one beside you when your soul embarks, then I will follow you into the dark." Now, Ruth only knows a fraction of Naomi's suffering. Ruth, of course, is dealing with her own suffering. She has had to bury her husband, Chilion. And you can imagine that Ruth is going through a very difficult time, but she sees Naomi going through the difficult time and more. And she promises to walk through this darkness with her. She does not abandon her. And Naomi, in her bitterness, does not have to suffer alone. You see, I think this is the second way that God works redemption within the story. God's redemption fosters human solidarity. Ruth is drawn toward Naomi and says, "I don't care if you hate God. I don't care if you feel bitter. I will be here with you. And we will find something worth living for at the end of this journey." God's redemption fosters human solidarity. And if you've ever had to watch someone that you love go through the darkness like Naomi did, the best thing you can do for them is not correct their theology, is not to invalidate their feelings, but instead simply say, "I will walk with you through the darkness." Which brings us to the third thing that God's redemption does. When I hear this story, and I think about Naomi saying that God has turned against me, I keep thinking back to when Naomi was young. And when she was told over and over again, Naomi, if you are faithful to God, then God will take care of you. If you are a woman of faith, then you won't have to suffer. Well, there is nothing within this story that tells us that Naomi wasn't a woman of faith. The fact is, there is no faith that prevents you from suffering. And Naomi felt the full weight of sin, of evil, of pain, of grieving within her lifetime. And you can imagine that after Naomi opens her heart to her husband, after she opens her heart to her son, after she opens her heart to her second son, and after having her heart ripped out of her ribcage and stomped on, not once, not twice, but three times, you can picture her turning to Ruth and saying, I will never love again. Love has kicked me and beaten me and left me for dead. I will never love again. Just let me die in peace. You wouldn't blame her, right? I mean, love has betrayed this woman on levels that I can barely imagine. And when you talk about life with the absence of love, you aren't talking about a life that is worth living. You are instead talking about life that is prison. Imagine that you could never love someone again. What would you be living for? So the third thing about God's redemption is God's redemption reopens one to love. If Naomi can somehow, someway open her heart again to love another, that would be a miracle beyond words, because she has done this time and time again, and she has had her heart stomped on time and time again. Now, this is where redemption speak often ends up superficial. The reason why is because we often view this reopening one's heart to love as a replacement. The idea is that Naomi has two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They both die. But if Naomi can somehow get pregnant again and have another son, then she can reopen her heart to love, as if this new son could replace what was lost before with Mahlon and Chilion. That is a superficial, terrible, just inhumane kind of answer. And so when we say that God's redemption reopens one to love, it is imperative that we remember the first step in God's redemption, that God's redemption remembers what was lost. To reopen one's heart to love does not require a replacement, but instead it is opening oneself up to saying, I believe that even though there may be pain down the road, life that is filled with love is worth living. So God's redemption reopens one to love. The story of Naomi continues. And after some time passes, Ruth meets a man named Boaz. Boaz marries Ruth, and Ruth becomes pregnant. Ruth then gives birth to a healthy baby boy named Obed. And she takes that baby boy and places it in Naomi's arms. We then read in Ruth chapter 4, verse 17, then Naomi took the child and laid him in her bosom and became his nurse. And Naomi's weathered, torn heart begins to love again. Now, at this point, if you could imagine that Naomi is a guest on this podcast at the end of her life, if we were to ask her, can you tell us about God? What do you think she would say? I think she would say to us, when I gave up on God, God made a way for me through the darkness, and I learned to love again. My brothers and sisters, may we never forget that God's redemption is for our suffering now. That God's redemption remembers what was lost. That God's redemption fosters human solidarity. And that God's redemption reopens one to love. And may you see and embrace Jesus Christ in all, even in the darkness.